9. At one time it was reported about the town that our little circle was a hotbed of nihilism, profligacy, and godlessness, and the rumour gained more and more strength, and yet we did nothing but indulge in the most harmless, agreeable, typically Russian, light-hearted, liberal chatter. The higher liberalism and the higher liberal, that is, a liberal without any definite aim, is only possible in Russia. Stepan Trofimovich, like every witty man, needed a listener, and besides that, he needed the consciousness that he was fulfilling the lofty duty of disseminating ideas. And finally, he had to have someone to drink champagne with, and over the wine to exchange light-hearted views of a certain sort about Russia and the Russian spirit, about God in general and the Russian God in particular, to repeat for the 100th time the same Russian scandalous stories that everyone knew and everyone repeated. We had no distaste for the gossip of the town, which often, indeed, led us to the most severe and loftily moral verdicts. We fell into generalizing about humanity, made stern reflections on the future of Europe and mankind in general, authoritatively predicted that after Caesarism, France would at once sink into the position of a second-rate power, and were firmly convinced that this might terribly easily and quickly come to pass. We had long ago predicted that the Pope would play the part of a simple archbishop in a united Italy, and were firmly convinced that this thousand-year-old question had, in our age of humanitarianism, industry, and railways, become a trifling matter. But, of course, Russian higher liberalism could not look at the question in any other way. Stepan Trofimovich sometimes talked of art, and very well, though rather abstractly. He sometimes spoke of the friends of his youth, all names noteworthy in the history of Russian progress. He talked of them with emotion and reverence, though sometimes with envy. If we were very much bored, the Jew, Lyamshin, a little post office clerk, a wonderful performer on the piano, sat down to play, and in the intervals would imitate a pig, a thunderstorm, a confinement with the first cry of the baby, and so on and so on. It was only for this that he was invited, indeed. If we had drunk a great deal, and that did happen sometimes, though not often, we flew into raptures, and even on one occasion sang the Marseillaise in chorus to the accompaniment of Lyamshin, though I don't know how it went off. The great day, the 19th of February, we welcomed enthusiastically, and for a long time beforehand drank toasts in its honour. But that was long ago, before the advent of Shatov or Virginsky, when Stepan Trofimovich was still living in the same house with Varvara Petrovna. For some time before the great day, Stepan Trofimovich fell into the habit of muttering to himself well-known, though rather far-fetched, lines, which must have been written by some liberal landowner of the past. "The peasant with his axe is coming. Something terrible will happen." Something of that sort. I don't remember the exact words. Varvara Petrovna overheard him on one occasion, and crying, "Nonsense! Nonsense!" she went out of the room in a rage. Liputin, who happened to be present, observed malignantly to Stepan Trofimovich, "It'll be a pity if their former serfs really do some mischief to messieurs les landowners to celebrate the occasion," and he drew his forefinger round his throat. "Cher ami," Stepan Trofimovich observed, "believe me that this," he repeated the gesture, "will never be of any use to our landowners, nor to any of us in general. We shall never be capable of organizing anything even without our heads, though our heads hinder our understanding more than anything. I may observe that many people among us anticipated that something extraordinary, such as Liputin predicted, would take place on the day of the emancipation, and those who held this view were the so-called authorities on the peasantry and the government. I believe Stepan Trofimovitch shared this idea so much that almost on the eve of the great day he began asking Varvara Petrovna's leave to go abroad. In fact, he began to be uneasy. But the great day passed, and some time passed after it, and the condescending smile reappeared on Stepan Trofimovitch's lips. In our presence, he delivered himself of some noteworthy thoughts on the character of the Russian in general, and the Russian peasant in particular. "Like hasty people, we have been in too great a hurry with our peasants," he said in conclusion of a series of remarkable utterances. "We have made them the fashion, and a whole section of writers have for several years treated them as though they were newly discovered curiosities. We have put laurel wreaths on lousy heads. The Russian village has given us only Kamarinsky in 1,000 years. A remarkable Russian poet who was also something of a wit, seeing the great Rachel on the stage for the first time, cried in ecstasy, 'I wouldn't exchange Rachel for a peasant.' I am prepared to go further. I would. Give all the peasants in Russia for one Rachel. It's high time to look things in the face more soberly, and not to mix up our national rustic pitch with bouquet de l'impératrice.'" Liputin agreed at once, but remarked that one had to perjure oneself and praise the peasant all the same for the sake of being progressive, that even ladies in good society shed tears reading Poor Anton, and that some of them even wrote from Paris to their bailiffs that they were, henceforward, to treat the peasants as humanely as possible. It happened, and as ill luck would have it, just after the rumours of the Anton Petrov affair had reached us, that there was some disturbance in our province too, only about 10 miles from Skorveshniki, so that a detachment of soldiers was sent down in a hurry. This time Stepan Trofimovitch was so much upset that he even frightened us. He cried out at the club that more troops were needed, that they ought to be telegraphed for from another province. He rushed off to the governor to protest that he had no hand in it, begged him not to allow his name on account of old associations to be brought into it, and offered to write about his protest to the proper quarter in Petersburg. Fortunately, it all passed over quickly and ended in nothing. But I was surprised at Stepan Trofimovitch at the time. 3 years later, as everyone knows, people were beginning to talk of nationalism, and public opinion first came upon the scene. Stepan Trofimovitch laughed a great deal. "My friends," he instructed us, "if our nationalism has dawned, as they keep repeating in the papers, it's still at school, at some German Peterschule, sitting over a German book and repeating its everlasting German lesson, and its German teacher will make it go down on its knees when he thinks fit. I think highly of the German teacher. But nothing has happened, and nothing of the kind has dawned, and everything is going on in the old way, that is, as ordained by God. To my thinking, that should be enough for Russia. Poor Notre Sainte Russie. Besides, all this Slavism and nationalism is too old to be new. Nationalism, if you like, has never existed among us except as a distraction for gentlemen's clubs, and Moscow ones at that. I'm not talking of the days of Igor, of course, and besides, it all comes of idleness. Everything in Russia comes of idleness, everything good and fine even. It all springs from the charming, cultured, whimsical idleness of our gentry. I'm ready to repeat it for 30,000 years. We don't know how to live by our own labour. And as for the fuss they're making now about the dawn of some sort of public opinion, has it so suddenly dropped from heaven without any warning? How is it that they don't understand that before we can have an opinion of our own, we must have work, our own initiative in things, our own experience? Nothing is to be gained for nothing. If we work, we shall have an opinion of our own. But as we never shall work, our opinions will be formed for us, by those who have hitherto done the work instead of us. That is, as always, Europe, the everlasting Germans, our teachers for the last 2 centuries. Moreover, Russia is too big a tangle for us to unravel alone without the Germans and without hard work. For the last 20 years, I've been sounding the alarm and the summons to work. I've given up my life to that appeal, and in my folly I put faith in it. Now I have lost faith in it, but I sound the alarm still, and shall sound it to the tomb. I will pull at the bell ropes until they toll for my own requiem. Alas, we could do nothing but assent. We applauded our teacher, and with what warmth, indeed. And after all, my friends, don't we still hear today, every hour, at every step, the game charming, clever, liberal, old Russian nonsense? Our teacher believed in God. I can't understand why they make me out an infidel here, he used to say sometimes. I believe in God, mais distinguons. I believe in him as a being who is conscious of himself in me only. I cannot believe as my Nastasia, the servant, or like some country gentleman who believes to be on the safe side, or like our dear Shatov. But no, Shatov doesn't come into it. Shatov believes on principle, like a Moscow Slavophil. As for Christianity, for all my genuine respect for it, I'm not a Christian. I am more of an antique pagan, like the great Goethe, or like an ancient Greek. The very fact that Christianity has failed to understand woman is enough, as George Sand has so splendidly shown in one of her great novels. As for the bowings, fasting, and all the rest of it, I don't understand what they have to do with me. However busy the informers may be here, I don't care to become a Jesuit. In the year 1847, Bielinski, who was abroad, sent his famous letter to Gogol and warmly reproached him for believing in some sort of God. Entre nous soit dit. I can imagine nothing more comic than the moment when Gogol, the Gogol of that period, read that phrase and the whole letter. But dismissing the humorous aspect, and, as I am fundamentally in agreement, I point to them and say, these were men. They knew how to love their people. They knew how to suffer for them. They knew how to sacrifice everything for them. Yet they knew how to differ from them when they ought, and did not filch certain ideas from them. Could Bielinski have sought salvation in Lenten oil or peas with radish? But at this point, Shatov interposed. Those men of yours never loved the people. They didn't suffer for them, and they didn't sacrifice anything for them, though they may have amused themselves by imagining it, he growled sullenly, looking down and moving impatiently in his chair. They didn't love the people, yelled Stepan Trofimovich. Oh, how they loved Russia! Neither Russia nor the people, Shatov yelled too with flashing eyes. You can't love what you don't know. And they had no conception of the Russian people. All of them peered at the Russian people through their fingers, and you do too. Bielinski especially. From that very letter to Gogol, one can see it. Bielinski, like the inquisitive man in Krylov's fable, did not notice the elephant in the Museum of Curiosities, but concentrated his whole attention on the French socialist beetles. He did not get beyond them, and yet perhaps he was cleverer than any of you. You've not only overlooked the people, you've taken up an attitude of disgusting contempt for them, if only because you could not imagine any but the French people. The Parisians, indeed, and were ashamed that the Russians were not like them. That's the naked truth. And he who has no people has no God. You may be sure that all who cease to understand their own people and lose their connection with them at once lose to the same extent the faith of their fathers and become atheistic or indifferent. I'm speaking the truth. This is a fact which will be realized. That's why all of you and all of us now are either beastly atheists or careless, dissolute imbeciles and nothing more. And you too, Stepan Trofimovich, I don't make an exception of you at all. In fact, it is on your account I am speaking, let me tell you that. As a rule, after uttering such monologues, which happened to him pretty frequently, Shatov snatched up his cap and rushed to the door in the full conviction that everything was now over, and that he had cut short all friendly relations with Stepan Trofimovich forever, but the latter always succeeded in stopping him in time. "Hadn't we better make it up, Shatov, after all these endearments?" he would say, benignly holding out his hand for him from the armchair. Shatov, clumsy and bashful, disliked sentimentality. Externally he was rough, but inwardly, I believe, he had great delicacy. Although he often went too far, he was the first to suffer for it. Muttering something between his teeth in response to Stepan Trofimovich's appeal, and shuffling with his feet like a bear, he gave a sudden and unexpected smile, put down his cap, and sat down in the same chair as before, with his eyes stubbornly fixed on the ground. Wine was, of course, brought in, and Stepan Trofimovich proposed some suitable toast, for instance, the memory of some leading man of the past.